Welcome back to the Coaches Rising podcast. I am really delighted today to be hosting Dr. Lawrence Heller. He is the creator of NARM, which stands for Neuroaffective Relational Model. And I love this approach. I've worked with NARM therapists. It's a really cutting edge, trauma-informed approach to our thriving. And so we're going to explore NARM today. We're going to explore its relevancy for coaching and why more and more coaches are actually training in their approach. We'll talk about why they place aliveness at the center of their work. And we'll then explore what are the barriers towards aliveness and how can we actually metabolize those. We'll talk about some of the universal principles within NARM and some of the deeper depths of the work, getting into how our spiritual capacities expand as we move into this work and the transformation of the heart. A few more words about Lawrence. He is the founder of the NARM Training Institute, which is training practitioners throughout US and Europe. And he is the co-author of the groundbreaking book, Healing Developmental Trauma, which I highly recommend. His more recent work addresses the societal and cultural dimensions of trauma. So I highly recommend you investigate Dr. Lawrence Heller's work more fully. And let's dive in. Here's the podcast with Dr. Lawrence Heller. Before we get into today's podcast, I'd like to take a moment to tell you about our new program, The Art of Developmental Coaching, which is enrolling now. It's the first time we've run this in 3 years, and we've made some big upgrades to this one. In preparation for this, I was reading the session descriptions, and I got so excited about what you're going to learn in this program. It's based on a brilliant body of work created by a developmental psychologist, and it will teach you a superpower, and that's how to hear what's underneath your client's words to the meaning that they're making, so you can reveal the source of their challenges. It's as if you support them to see what their own mind was hiding from them, where they can unhook from long-standing patterns. Some of the other cool things you're going to learn in this program are the role of complexity in our evolution. It's a buzz topic in the field of coaching right now. We are in a complexity dojo, and you're going to learn how this is actually a good thing in that we can support our clients to evolve, harnessing the currents of complexity in their development. You're also going to learn something remarkable. We've got, I think, one of the world's leading pedagogies on practice design. This has been an area of challenge in my own coaching in the early years. How can we design developmentally appropriate practices which are personalized for our clients and their topics? Micro practices which build on top of each other so that they begin to inhabit a new way of being which helps them thrive. You'll also learn about one of the magic alchemical levers in development, polarities. Once you learn about polarities and how they're often at play in our own development, you'll see them everywhere with our clients, and you'll be able to harness that tension in service of your client's evolution. You're also going to learn about culture and how our individual development connects to the culture, whether that's the community culture or the organizational culture that we're in. And coaching specifically, that relationship, which is so potent. Lastly, you're going to learn practices that help you expand your state and attune to the relational field that we co-create with our clients. I also want to let you know that we have made your own development a priority in this program. It is the difference that makes a difference in the potency of your coaching, and it will support you to become the coach this moment is asking for. You will be invited to clarify your own developmental edge and use everything I've just described, all the tools and practices, to your own development. There will be specifically designed practices, questions, and inquiries you can engage with the cohort in this process. So it's a very potent learning container. And if you want to find out more, you can head to coachesrising.com/developmental coaching. Early bird is now open. So Lawrence, yeah, really good to be with you today. I've been waiting for this conversation for quite some time after our mutual acquaintance, Ralph, introduced us. So it's great to be with you. How are you today?
I'm good. And it's nice to be here with you as well. I've also heard via Ralph, I've heard a lot about you. So
excellent. Yeah, I hope we get into maybe some more of the kind of personal influences of what informed your work today, actually. I just want to start by saying, we're going to talk about NAM therapy, which I think is for me one of the most innovative, leading edge modalities I've come across, and I found it really stunning to be working with NAM therapists. So,
Thank you.
yeah. And I think a context I shared with you just before we hit record was, I see, I don't know if this is really that true, but it seems like there are therapeutic modalities that are kind of moving more to the center, focusing around, human thriving. And then there are coaching modalities moving the other direction into the center, recognizing the importance of working on a deeper level with the whole human being and their what kind of influenced their coming, into maturity. And so maybe that's the space we'll play in today. Maybe you could just, I think aliveness is when I, when I look at your work, it's a big kind of core element of NAM. Could you talk about why you think aliveness is so central, so important, and yeah, what's in a sense like my tears up, what obstructs human aliveness, and how does NAM go about restoring it, or how, what restores it? Yeah.
Well, when you listen to people and you really listen, and what they're saying is that's central to human life. It's like, oh, I never felt so alive in ABC, whatever situation, how important that is for human beings. And so it's strange. Once I was years ago now, I was interviewed and he said, what's with all this aliveness stuff? It seems so automatic to me that, of course, that's basic. And in the NAR model, I do talk about the spontaneous movement in all of us is towards connection, health, and aliveness. And then goes on and on. But then the bottom line is here that what we do is we explore what's gotten in the way of the capacity for connection, the capacity for aliveness. And of course, with that comes capacity for self-regulation, capacity for relationship, capacity, a healthier relationship with self. In other words, working with toxic shame and guilt and self-rejection. All those dynamics come into play because they all, in different ways, but in some similar ways as well, they get in the way of the aliveness, which I consider our birthright as human beings. All we have to do is look at a healthy child and we can see, the aliveness there that often we're no longer so significantly connected to. And the tendency is we have some great experiences as adults where we really feel alive. And then we tend to give the experience itself the credit and not realize that the experience was just the vehicle that helped us tap into this birthright, as I call it, of aliveness that is who we are when we're no longer dealing with the obstacles, the emotional obstacles, the somatic obstacles, the identity obstacles that are getting in the way of that full expression and experience of aliveness.
And I think what's fascinating about this, before we go a bit deeper into the obstructions to aliveness, one of the topics we've had on the podcast, I'd love to ask you this. It just comes to me as you speak, is a deep questioning of what a certain paradigm might be based on. For example, coaching, you might say this, and I mean, others would disagree, but you could say coaching has been based on helping one achieve something, become successful in a way. And I think people are starting to question these deep beliefs in a way that, they've emerged out of certain paradigms. And, I'm now hearing more and more people speak about wisdom. Actually, could that be a more, a better metric of measurement, meaning, thriving? Yeah, what do you
Well,
think?
thriving,
Yeah.
definitely. And wisdom, as long as it's an embodied wisdom, because there are people who have wisdom who are really disconnected. But so I like to talk about embodied wisdom. And That's a, for me, that's where the juice is. That's where the aliveness is. So we can have abstract thinking and be very clear-minded, but not really connected to our bodies and our emotions and other people. That's not an unusual dynamic, actually. So
Do you see a connection between that embodied wisdom and aliveness?
Yeah, the aliveness is there. It is an aspect of that is at least mediated through the body, this force of aliveness, which so it's essential. The other thing, thinking about what you said a moment ago too, is that in terms of coaching, there, from my point of view, as a not and I'm a non-coach, but there was always so much focus on performance from the coaches that I met, and performance can be a very useful metric and use, you know, and things that, but in NARM, we focus on, again, the deeper dynamics that are at play that get in the way of being most who we are, most in touch with the capacities that we have and that we can develop. And so it's a basic, it's what I call the, it's part of the first pillar in NARM. Like, what is it that a person wants? I know that's a familiar question for coaches, which is not so familiar with all therapists, honestly, but it's, what do you want? And then instead of creating behavioral goals on how to get there, our understanding, what we call contract in quotes, is to explore what's getting in the way of them having or being what or who they want to be or truly are. And so generally I can say that the exploration evolves around learned dynamics, often various forms of environmental failure, that is, I use that very broad category, but various forms of environmental failure that we've internalized and carried forward, which then get in the way of the aliveness that, again, is our birthright. And this is, in a way, this is almost a pretty much a universal story for people. Now, it varies hugely in terms of degree, because some people have experienced extreme environmental failure, neglect, abuse, chronic misattunement, and so on. Other people have experienced the everyday misattunement or the everyday kind of, you know, as a child, being with people who maybe just have a little difficulty with the their aliveness for a variety of reasons we can choose to talk about later. But so there is a spectrum here, but still there are, all of these dynamics are learned. And in NARM, we talk about, through exploration and inquiry, a certain kind of inquiry, we can work through those internalized obstacles that we're all carrying around in one degree or another.
I just want to make this comment because I might forget. Want to ask about developmental kind of trauma and shock trauma. But the thing that I'm sat with is, first of all, if I think about a lot of what motivates me, you know, even the ambitions I have, it's really when I look at it, it's the sense of fulfillment and aliveness that I'll feel in those experiences.
Right. You know,
that's the first principle. It's like, and so I'm thinking, this is the comment, the thought I had, which was like, a lot of coaching has focused on performance. And if you think about it, a lot of performance can be kind of conditioned and inhibited, you know, by our, the ways, the experiences we've had as we've grown up. So what kind of performance would come online as someone was able to reclaim more and more of that aliveness, that liberated kind of energy, direct correlation with leadership, you know?
Yeah. Well, one of the later learned obstacles is when you grow up in families where your self-worth and then ultimately your self-esteem is based on how you look and how you perform. So when people are performing from that place, they're already digging themselves into a hole because they're constantly feeling the need to prove themselves, which is the obstacle to actually performing at your best, because you're coming often from trying to convince somebody, a parent often, often enough, anyway, you know, that's a very common dynamic. Trying to convince a parent that you're really worthy or worthwhile. And that kind of focus on performance is coming from a hurt and wounded place in people. And if there's so much energy that's freed up when the performance, our orientation towards performance is driven just by what you said, because it brings aliveness. When we use our capacities, we feel alive. When we experience a certain kind of mastery in whatever field or endeavor that we're involved in, that brings aliveness, and it often brings a sense of connection. If you're feeling alive, you're feeling connected to your body and to, and often then to other people as well. Whereas when you're coming from one of the five survival styles, it's always compromised. That aliveness and that capacity for connection is compromised in some way and in different ways, and sometimes a whole variety of ways.
So let's go into the process a bit more of, you know, how we get conditioned away. You know, our aliveness gets kind of conditioned or diminished. And you mentioned the five survival styles there. Could you say a little bit more? Could you unpack more? You mentioned, you know, like adverse childhood experiences, and you know, there's ways that our environment, you know, isn't meeting our needs, and that has a certain impact. Could you kind of like kind of sketch out a little bit that process of how we become more conditioned and then these survival styles kick in?
I'd be happy to, and I'd first like to address the word conditioning, because it's commonly used in both psychological fields and spiritual work. You know, we talk about conditioning. In NARM, I never talk about well, when you're talking about cultural conditioning, it's a little different, but when I'm talking about what we've learned in families, I don't use the word conditioning. Because when we think about the word conditioning, it's based on a model that's stimulus response. And it's never that simple. When it's true when you're working with pigeons like Skinner or other behaviorists, you know, who use operant conditioning. But it isn't so true with human beings, because we start off, you know, basically bodies and so on. And then the organizing self develops, and it responds to the environmental processes and failures and successes that we've experienced. And so what I'm doing is not deconditioning people, but helping people experience increasingly this organizing self that views the world through the various lenses of the survival style, which in some way represents a distortion of both themselves, their sense of self, and the world and other people. So it's it's an important distinction between conditioning and what we as human beings primarily experience, you know, in our development, in various developmental stages.
What makes that distinction you've just made? What's the most important thing about it, rather than seeing it like conditioning, than, you know, this distortion?
Perfect question. I mean that because what that means is that we have agency that we never knew we had. You know, as soon as we can start to see that when we're triggered, let's say, by something, it's not just a stimulus response. There's a stimulus, then we organize, usually implicitly or unconsciously, we organize our reactions based on reaction to that trigger based on, you know, well, our survival styles, our personal history, and so on and so forth. And that means that even though we didn't start these dynamics, the more awareness that we bring to these dynamics, the more agency we experience, the less we experience ourselves at the mercy of other people, at the mercy of life itself. We experience an increasing sense of agency, which is nothing like blame. It's everything to do with a sense of freedom that we do consciously or unconsciously make all kinds of choices in our lives. And for the biggest part, unconsciously, for some of the most important things, they're not really consciously thought out. They're more what I talk about as child consciousness based. And they limit us. And agency then, when you don't look at it as conditioning, but as a distorted sense of self that you developed in the, let's call it a mirror of our early childhood of experience, that is subject to quicker and more immediate change than we've ever realized. When we realize that we're continuing whatever environmental failure we experienced, we continue and carry it forward into adulthood.
So what I'm also hearing in what you say there is there's a kind of recognition of the intelligence of that distortion, you know, that it in some way it took care of us. And I'm hearing that, you know, when you're working with someone, there's something very liberating about helping people become self-aware, become aware of these distortions as they're showing up in the moment. And I know we're going to go more deeply into, you know, what are some of the moves non-therapists make, non-practitioners make in a bit more detail later. But that's kind of what's coming up.
Again, you touched on a really important theme, which is the exact same adaptations, and that's what I talk about them as, the exact same adaptations that we make to the environment as children that once saved our lives, as we carry them forward into adulthood, are the same changes, the same strategies that we developed that now create the symptoms and the limitations that we experience as adults.
Right. Could you say a bit more about then the process of, you know, how they get taken on and then turn into survival style? So, you know, I'm aware of, in a sense, like we're a child in an environment and certain needs don't get met. And then, you know, there's a process we go through. Could you go into that a bit more detail?
Yeah. Happily, yeah, because the original title of my first book on developmental trauma was actually called Connection, Our Deepest Desire and Greatest Fear. Now, it is our deepest desire. It only becomes fearful when we've learned to survive by disconnecting. So all of the survival styles represent some form of disconnection that it once helped us to survive. So, for example, the first survival style that I talk about in ARM is the connection survival style. It's named for the missing capacity, or at least compromised capacity. So one of the things that children, particularly when they're very early trauma, pre-verbal trauma, sometimes even prenatal trauma, birth trauma, or early attachment trauma, the way that children manage is by disconnecting. And when it's too severe, they can shut down their emotions, they can shut down their body, they can disconnect from other people, they withdraw into themselves, or they go out of their bodies, you know, into their heads or into the energetic field. There's a certain kind of escape when other escape isn't possible. It's a dissociative process. And what I talk about when I teach people about dissociation is that capacity which helps human beings bear the unbearable. And the problem is that we continue using disconnection dynamics in various aspects of our lives the whole entire rest of our life, unless life experiences change it, or psychotherapy changes it, or something significant goes on that changes that. We will continue to, you know, to see other people as a threat. We will continue to feel emotions and self-awareness of the body as a threat until we experience that that's not the case. And you can talk about it and you can read about it, but you have to experience it to know it. And NARM is very, as we sometimes say, phenomenological or experiential moment, that kind of moment to moment, like exploration of, like, for example, the connection disconnection process, because it's right there in front of us in the room. And we track that with clients and we reflect that. And then we explore what it is that they're disconnecting from and what are the various ideas and identifications that they're carrying around that, you know, get threatened and from which then they disconnect. So disconnection, and this disconnection is part of the process in all the survival styles. It just varies. So it's a very profound disconnection with this first and earliest developmental survival style. Then I talk about attunement. Basically, these are individuals who disconnected from their needs at a very early age because their needs were not being met, and they learned to adapt to very little. And it could get more complicated. I won't go too much in, but then we develop behavioral strategies. One of the very common behavioral strategies for people with the attunement survival style is to become helpers, helping professionals. They're taking care of other people's needs, but they don't know how to focus on their own. Of course, it leads to burnout and all these other dynamics. And so we're looking at how they've learned to disconnect from their needs, because needing for them, needing something from someone else is associated with shame and humiliation and helplessness too, as well. And so one way they've learned to manage it then is to be the helper. And they kind of secure a position. They're important to people, but they continue the dynamic of disconnecting from their needs, which they end up paying a price for when they do this long term. So then third, and I'll go through this very briefly. I won't elaborate so much on each one because we could spend a lot of time. But the third one is what I call the trust survival style. These are individuals who learned that they could not trust, that their dependency and their helplessness as children was in a variety of ways used against them. And for example, they're enlisted to become the sports star that their father never was, or was and wanted to have in his son, or I'm just using stereotypes here, but the stage mother or ballerina mother who wants her daughter to be and accomplish what she never could. So it's tricky because they're getting lots of strokes. They're being groomed, to use a word that's gotten increasingly popular. But they're being missed because it's not about them. It's about the parents' needs. And to make a long story short, one of the strategies then that these children use is to make this kind of vow to themselves that they'll never be used again, because they feel that they, on some level, more than some of the earlier survival styles, they have a sense that they're being used, but it feels good and it's confusing. And so one of their strategies is to always be in control, always to be in power, never to depend on anybody for anything as far as is possible for them. So that's trust. And then there's two more I'll say very briefly. Then there's the autonomy survival style, who was not supported to in their own autonomy. They were not supported to separate and individuate from the parents. And as a matter of fact, often they were undermined. They might have been, gotten their some of their basic needs met that we've been talking about in the early survival styles. But when they go to become their own separate being, one or both of the parents find ways to get in the way. Now, it can either be very rigid and controlling parents, or parents with anxiety about being abandoned themselves, and they see the child's increasing autonomy as abandonment. And so the autonomy survival style go underground. So they end up being on the surface very sweet and nice and pleasing people. And on the deepest level, it's this holding out. And the idea is, you've got my body, but you're never going to get my soul, so screw you. So, and some of those individuals with the autonomy survival style recognize that in themselves. Some have no idea. They just think that they want to be pleasing all the time, yet their behavior shows something different. And then finally, we actually touched on the love sexuality one, where they grow up in families where their value is based on how they look and how they perform, which means they're not valued at all, because you're only as good as your last success. And failure means not just something disappointing, but a kind of collapse of this sense of self that's based on how you look and how you perform. So all of these dynamics, even though they saved our lives, they have a built-in pain factor that is implicit in each one of them. And of course, just to be clarified, because a lot of people have the question, you can identify with one or more of these survival styles. As a matter of fact, it's normal that many people can relate to several, two, three, and even more.
Yeah, and I think as you were naming them and the characteristics, and I was just thinking of how, I recognize them in myself, and how much they could inform leaders. A lot of people listening to this, coach, leaders, and I use that term very broadly, from a leader of a community to a leader of an organization. So, and the point I want to make there is, that's a lot about leading other people or being in connection with other people. You know, so I'm saying that because that just emphasizes how much these survival styles will be playing out as you're in relationship to other people. And there's something about this. Well, let me ask, before I ask that question, I'm curious, because before we hit record, you said a lot of people coming now to train with NAM are actually coaches, and you're creating coach specific offerings. And I wonder what the possibility is that you see for people in, the coaching industry to kind of learn about NAM and its principles, maybe in relationship to these survival styles that we've named. Do you see the coaches, in a sense, learning about those styles and that informing the work they do with the people they're coaching?
Well, interestingly, that is exactly what we've been experiencing. Now, we have a training, we have different levels of training. We do have trainings that are only for psychotherapists, but we do have a specific training that is open to coaches and other helping professionals, people who want to be trauma-informed, who want just a general understanding of NARM and how to apply it in their particular field. Now, as I mentioned to you before we started, it turns out that we've ended up with a lot of coaches in our work, and as a result, as I mentioned to you, we decided it would be important. We got accreditation from the International Coaching International Coaching Federation, so that coaches can get the continuing education points or whatever it's called in different countries, and they found it very useful to move from primarily a behavioral kind of metric to looking at the deeper emotional dynamics that are getting in the way of the kind of success or the kind of higher level performance that they're looking for. So we believe that we're taking that these dynamics to a deeper level by exploring the emotional and other elements and identity, because each one of these survival styles represents a distortion in identity. So that when I talk about identity distortions, I'm not being critical. I'm just saying that we're not seeing the world as it is. We're seeing the world through the lens of this survival style that we developed in order to survive in a difficult situation when we were children, usually. So by going to the deeper dynamics, the feedback that we've gotten from coaches is that this has been incredibly helpful for them. And in terms of their coaching work. And so as we've noticed that the cohort of coaches has increased progressively in the time that we've been offering this training, we've got planned a continuing segment. It won't be available for at least 6 months, but we've got this where it will be, there will be a subsection after the basic training specifically for coaches to apply to their work and how this, the basic principles that you learn in the what we call the NBT, the non-basic training, can be applied specifically to coaches, because we've just come to see that it's an important audience for us.
I think we could get into some of those principles in a moment. I really love what you say there about going beneath, behavioral goals and performance into, what's the identity that I've taken on that's, getting in the way or it's reached the end of its, it was very useful. It kept us safe and then connected in belonging. Mm-hmm. But now perhaps it's kind of confining us in some ways. And I wonder what you think about this, and this might segue, because this, I know, what this is, one of the things I really appreciated about NARM was how it is working with the present moment in a non-pathologizing way. Mm-hmm. And what I see in coaching now and in other fields as well is a move into approaches which reject kind of self-improvement paradigm, or at least recognize the limits of it, maybe not reject it outright. This idea that, often it's like, well, here I am now, and then I want to be over there, and I'm going to kind of, in a sense, like strategize or use effort to get over there. But what it actually often does is it kind of reinforces a sense of there's something wrong with me as I am. It creates this tension with our experience, like, and actually can be very counterproductive to that deeper transformation. So I see types of coaching now, which, in a sense, they're working with, well, what's here right now as we just explore this topic? They're moving very much into the present moment and becoming aware of what's actually unfolding in the present moment and letting that be. And as they do, that's when the kind of integration or and actually I'd never used the word aliveness, but I think there is a sense of, with my clients I've seen they drop into a sense of aliveness. And so that I said a lot there, but I wonder how that lands for you, and maybe that's a segue into some of these principles of how you would go about reclaiming aliveness or
Well, it honestly, it fits exactly into our paradigm. And I can kind of elaborate a little on that, but I'm just going to share this association. Our podcast series is called the Aliveness Project, so, because it does so much revolve around not just fitting in or being more functional, but really what we sometimes talk about is transformation through the trauma work that we do. We're not just looking to get them back to baseline. We're looking to help people unlock potential and capacities that they had been, in some ways, unavailable. It wasn't, they weren't available to access with the person. So what you're saying there is really fits in. And another piece that you mentioned that also very much fits in is that when you're coming from a place of quote unquote, as you mentioned, improving yourself, implicitly there's a self-rejection there. It's like, I'm not good enough as I am, so I'm going to make myself better. Well, it's painful, even when we don't realize that that's what we're formulating. That implicit self-rejection is painful, and that part of ourself that is being left behind and being judged is going to, in some ways, come out to sabotage the process. So it's really important that we understand our limitations through the lens of how they helped us make it as far as we have. It doesn't mean we have to give them up, but they're now no longer in the investment isn't in so-called self-improvement. The investment is in accessing the deeper aspects and capacities of ourselves and manifesting those. That's a can be a problematical word, but using those capacities and enjoying those capacities, because as you and I talked about off camera, there's such pleasure in using the capacities that we have and that we've developed in, to be able to share those with the world and share those with other people and to have those capacities impact others as well. So, yeah, I mean, so what you were saying was really very consistent with the NARM approach.
Beautiful, yeah. I bookmarked the deeper aspects of ourselves for later. What does a NARM therapist do when they're with a client? In a sense, I'm wondering about, what some of the, and in a way, I know we mentioned this before recording, what are some of the, I'm fascinated in what are like universal principles that inform these modalities that are arising. And for example, internal family systems has become incredibly popular. Something about that where they say if parts are trying to fix other parts, they polarize and that never really works. So disidentifying from a part into what they call self, and that seems to be a kind of tapping into a universal principle that when we identify with something larger, we can bring a kind of love and presence to these parts that wasn't possible when we're only inside parts. So, yeah, those kind of principles I'd love to see if we can tease out a little bit that inform NARM. Yeah,
Well,
what comes to mind to mention around these principles?
with Dick Schwartz, and somewhat familiar with his work, and he, with mine. And one thing we do have in common is really the acceptance of all of the parts of ourselves. I don't go into the parts work in other ways that he does, but that is a common principle that we agree on. Because the more that we have these split off parts that are then struggling and suffering, the more our energy and our self is actually divided against itself. So, acceptance of our parts, the various parts of ourselves, particularly the parts that we don't like, is important. To recognize and accept and understand the survival, value of these dysfunctional aspects of self, that we don't grow by rejecting ourselves. We grow by accepting ourselves. That doesn't mean staying stuck in these old patterns, but it does mean that we're not condemning ourselves, because that's actually, for many people, just a recapitulation of their history. You're not good enough, and you got to do better, and you got, you know. And so when we take that position with ourselves, there's actually a self-injury that's going on there, and your energy is divided, and you're basically trying to, improve yourself with the sword of Damocles hanging over your head, meaning which is that you're nothing if you don't improve. That puts so much pressure on some coaching processes, because when they don't get the results, either for, and sometimes the coach is disappointed, and the client is disappointed. And when you're turning, growth into a win-lose situation, that's a major obstacle just in itself. So, again, it's really important that we're not staying stuck in the past, but we're moving forward. And then you asked about some universal principles. So exploration is a universal principle in NARM. It's a whole different, perspective than symptom eradication, which is what is so common in the psychotherapy world. And sometimes I think in coaching too, but particularly in the psychotherapy world, like to get rid of a symptom, and that's their standard of improvement. And it's like, for me, that's so misguided. But it's not the eradication of a symptom. I mean, obviously, we trust in NARM that as people reconnect, and as they become more whole, and as they experience, and as they work through the various issues of the various survival styles, their symptoms do just fall away. But that's an indicator that something good is happening. But if you make that a goal-oriented process, you're missing the whole dynamic that's driving the symptoms. And NARM is profoundly interested in the client's inner world and the various internal conflicts that are driving these dysfunctional or less than optimal dynamics and symptoms that the person is experiencing. So I can go on with a couple more principles, or we can, you maybe want to interject something.
No, I think it's good. I mean, I'm thinking, and this might weave into some of the, might tee up some of the principles you're going to share next, but so I'm thinking that a client is there with a certain kind of dilemma or, issue, and then the NARM practitioner who sat there with them and is really attuning to this person on a, experiential level. And this kind of attitude of exploration is really essential. That there is a kind of bringing into awareness everything that's arising in the moment around the topic.
Absolutely. And exploration is based on one core principle, and that's curiosity. And for us to be curious about the difficulties we're having rather than to try and eliminate them, that changes the emotional dynamics immediately. Curiosity is just that. It's an openness. It's an assumption that we don't know, because when if we assume we know, we don't have to be curious about anything. But when we're curious, we're assuming we don't know what these dynamics are, and we're open to exploring and finding out what the dynamics actually are. And it's energetically and emotionally, it's a huge shift in direction, to be curious. So that's that, and that's part of the inquiry process. It's exploration oriented, as you know, that the, what I call the second pillar. Now, the third pillar I talk about was agency, to see, and this has actually been done more effectively sometimes in coaching than in psychotherapy, where sometimes in psychotherapy, everybody's viewed as just a victim of their past and they have no control and the best they can do. I mean, there's a lot of things. I won't get into it criticizing, at least any more than I already have. But the fact that we do have agency where we didn't know it. Now, you can't force it. But you, as you explore, you get to see that, oh, yeah, I've been doing this to myself. You know, so, for example, let me take a very common human, you know, challenge, rejection. You know, when you read books about rejection, it's always, oh, well, if you were rejected by somebody, then think about all the bad things you could think about them, or, you know, don't give him so much power or her so much power. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of like bromides that people get about rejection. But what I talk about when I'm teaching people and therapists and coaches about how to work with rejection is to see, let's say we want somebody romantically and they don't want us. So we experience that as rejection. And it's natural that if we want someone and they don't want us, we'll be disappointed. But the rejection piece isn't rejection. That's somebody who's just not wanting the same thing we want. So when you look at it from adult consciousness, it's simple. But we don't usually do that. Mostly, unless it, and then sometimes when we do it, it's just rationalization. As opposed to seeing that what begins then in us is the self-rejection process. So we start saying, oh, I'm not pretty enough. I'm not handsome enough. My thighs are this way. My nose. I'm not smart enough. I'm not tall enough. I mean, there's this constant dynamic of rejecting ourselves. Sometimes we'll reject ourselves in advance so we don't experience rejection. So we're interested in maybe chatting up somebody and we start talking ourselves out of it. Oh, they won't want me. They're too pretty. They're too this. They're too, you know, and so this self, and that with understanding how much of what we experience as quote unquote rejection is actually self-rejection, is a movement towards increasing agency. When we see that we're doing that to ourselves, that changes the calculus there.
I think this is a universal principle, if we can call them that. I mean, this, and I see it in coaching too. I see it's like, when we start to recognize that we are creating our experience of the world, you know, through the constructions we have around the sense of identity we have. And it's a profoundly rich and nuanced and deep thread to explore, because I think this is, you know, it gets into more of the esoteric traditions as well. They pointed at this, but, you know, this, in a sense, like the world is a subjective experience. And, so do you, and I found this rich in my own experience, to really take that on. It's like, you know, in a sense, I'm creating my experience of the world, and it's very liberating and it's humbling. At the same time, it's humbling because, you know, I'm continually contracting or reacting in the face of my experiences. So I'm curious if anything comes up there. And also, if you were with a client, how would you work with that principle of agency? Would it be that you would, you know, I mean, if you kind of said to them, hey, you're doing this to yourself, you know, I mean, that,
you know, they might, for the record, we would never say that, but
yeah. So how would you work with that principle?
Yeah. Well, for example, a very common dynamic that is brought to coaches and to psychotherapists is burnout. And we never preach about agency. That goes nowhere. It's actually hurtful. But when the client seems ready, as best we can, you know, determine, for example, they come and they say, well, I'm suffering from burnout. At the right moment, when there's a therapeutic alliance or an alliance with the coach, when you feel like you're working together and there's a certain amount of trust that's developed, and then we might say, well, I'll explore with you how you burned yourself out on your last job. There's agency. That's the language of agency. Now, some clients, a minority, but some clients will feel blamed. And then we have to address that if that's what they're doing to themselves at that moment. And even doing to themselves is an agency-based language. But sometimes, and then if they're open to that, and they see, well, yeah, they never set limits. They wanted to always prove themselves, so they took on more than they could handle. They pressured themselves all the time. When other people didn't do their jobs, they did their jobs. I mean, there's a whole variety of strategies that people use. But then they start to see, yeah, it wasn't just that I suffered from burnout, and it wasn't just, and they may have been objectively in a difficult environment. Still, where they grow is what they, when they see what they did. In that, even in that difficult environment, even if they chose, and rightly so, to get out of that environment, there's still useful information about why they stayed so long, what they did to themselves in that, in that context, and that is all involved with agency.
So how would you, because I know NAM does this, you could have a conceptual conversation about what you just shared, that, hey, we, and I know you said you don't talk about agency directly, but
We don't preach it. That's the
don't
thing.
preach it. Yeah,
Yeah.
don't preach it. How would you bring that conversation down into a kind of embodied somatic revelation? I mean, I know that's, every moment is unique, so it's a difficult question because we're talking about an abstract
It's
example, but
not. No, it's not.
yeah.
Because as a matter of fact, you just, well, this has happened several times already in our podcast together, because we were talking about universal principles, and I was getting to my last universal, well, not the last one, but one of the more significant universal principles, which is embodiment. And here's how the various pieces fit together that we've talked about, is that the mechanism of disconnection for all of us as human beings is the body. How do we disconnect? We disconnect at first by contracting and tensing ourselves. We disconnect by holding our breath. We disconnect by sometimes deeper contractions in the viscera, in the core, in the neck, in the joints, all, and when contract, and we're trying to do that to manage our experience. And we all know that, like when we're nervous watching a movie, and then finally, the person is saved, and we go, ah. Oh. So that we've been contracting against the anxiety that we're feeling for vicariously for the person, where I identified in the, with the film. But so it is a body, disconnection is a body-based dynamic. And if you don't bring the body into the narrative, you're missing a very important point. And the way we do that in NARM is the fourth pillar. So we track the connection and disconnection process, and we deconstruct it in both ways. So when people start to disconnect, I might say something like, I notice that you're tensing. We try to stay with what's observable in the client. I notice that you're, looks like you're grinding your jaw, or I notice that you're holding your breath. What are you, what's going on there right now? And so we bring their attention to the disconnection. As soon as the attention is brought to the disconnection, it starts to change just in that. But then we deconstruct what it was that they were starting to feel, that then they felt the impulse to disconnect from. Maybe it was anger. Maybe it was sadness. Maybe it was something else. But so the deconstruction part is part of the inquiry, the second pillar piece. But we do it by focusing on not just the verbal narrative, but what we're observing in the client, and the resonance too, the resonance that we feel when we're working with clients. So all of these are sources of information, and we bring that to their attention. Now that's when they're disconnecting. On the other side of the, the coin is when people are reconnecting, when they've had an important insight or completed a significant emotion that was unresolved for them, we always will then bring that process back to the body. And as you, as you felt that anger, as you felt that grief, what's happening in your body right now? Now, most people can go there. Some people can't go to their body, and then we respect that, of course. We don't push them. But for those people who can go to their body, to anchor that insight or that new emotional freedom or whatever it might have been that changed in bodily experience is a significant step towards integration. And for me, without that step being part of the therapeutic process, you're missing a very significant element of completion.
Yeah, that's beautiful. You named that. I think that's often missed by coaches, actually, is when a kind of state of coherence or wholeness emerges, but then people move on, you know, and it's like, no,
yeah,
we can sit in that state together and kind of marinate in it. And but I want to ask you about the deconstructing, what that means, and in a sense, what the are you saying that the client's sharing their topic, the non-practitioner's inviting them into curiosity, and there's an exploration, they're experiencing on an embodied level, they're having stuff reflected to them by the practitioner that maybe reveals something they didn't see. What's the mechanism that creates the, I don't know what word to use here, is it healing or integration, or brings forth the metabolization of the barrier to aliveness?
Well, there are two questions there, really. Let me kind of take them one at a time, because you first asked about the deconstruction. The deconstruction piece is slowing the whole process down, because when we have a reaction, it's often very quick. Somebody hurts our feelings, and it's very quick. So let's say we get what's sometimes called triggered by somebody else's comment. Instead of just taking that at face value, we say, okay, and we do this in the here and now. So thinking back about this person at work or this love interest or whatever it was that you felt really hurt, or maybe the first thing that they were aware of was anger, whatever their reaction is, it doesn't matter ultimately. We say, let's look at what it is that you actually hurt you. Let's look at exactly what it is that you're getting angry about. And we start then to slow the process down and look into the details of the reaction in a way that in the moment that they experience it, it happens so quickly that they don't have the time to do that. Out of that slowing the process down comes a great deal of awareness, insight on an intellectual level, emotional awareness of it may have been that they got angry, but what really was it hurt their feelings. Then we explore, well, what was it exactly that hurt? Let's say if that's their reaction. Well, it hurt because part of them in general believes it, believes or takes on what this other person said or what they interpreted from what the other person said. Because it's often, as you pointed out, we're in our little bubbles and we often don't really even hear the other person. We're just responding to our own, internal dynamics, the projections and so on. So by slowing it down, instead of then the child consciousness, as I talk about it, being the driver here, is that it becomes increasingly available to adult consciousness. And for me, embodied adult consciousness is really one of the most significant steps towards a more complete integration.
And is it that I like that description of deconstructing. So it's like, it feels like you're expanding everything out, kind of zooming in a sense, or, but by zooming in a sense, there's also a zooming out, the client is disidentifying from the experience. Is the adult conscious, the adult, you described, and this maybe gets to the second part of my question about what is the integration mechanism? Is it that in that moment the client will be, seeing that whole experience through a different lens now and through the adult, and that they're not playing out in the heat, identified with it. Now there's a kind of relationship to it? What is that integration mechanism?
Well, as you said, and I like the way you described it. It is consistent with the way I describe it, and probably why I like it, but it very much fits because you're both zooming in, looking at the details of the reaction, and in that process, there's a zooming out dynamic, which I talk about in NARM as disidentification, so that we can see that by zooming in and looking at the details, we start to take all of that less personally. So interestingly, and I often don't talk about this seeming paradox until later in some of the trainings, but it's so appropriate now, is that there's an increasing sense of our own subjectivity because we're more in touch with our bodies, our emotions, and our thoughts and belief systems and all of that. And so we have an increasing sense of self, increasing sense of subjectivity, which brings with it, seemingly paradoxically to some, an increasing objectivity. It's like we don't take our responses as seriously as we once did. So you could see that, some people would talk about it as a mindfulness process, or, and I mindfulness is fine, although I heard that Jon Kabat-Zinn is wanting to, he wishes that he had named it something else. But I also talk about it as a heartfulness process, so that we've become more heart-centered and we start taking our own internal dramas less seriously. And we take other people's dramas less seriously. And that doesn't mean we're disconnected. It's just the opposite. We're taking them less seriously because we're more connected. It's not the stoic, I'm gray rocking, as it's called, been called, like just standing back from things. But it is having, from this more disidentified place, it's having more objectivity about our own process and about other human beings.
I think this tees up a question I'd love to ask you about, your view of the potential for humanity, and the certain views of, spirituality, which maybe emphasized a kind of transcendent view of, a kind of renunciate view, renounce the body, the emotional world, relationships, they get in the way of awakening. And what seems to be proliferating around the world now, or at least I'm drawn to, which is to be fully embodied, to be fully connected, to kind of live a juicy life. But I certainly recognize, like, it's like feeling more but bothering you less. I think I'm stealing that phrase from someone else, but I recognize that in myself, where it's like, through the intimacy with experience, it's like it you I move more into a kind of fluid experience where constructs, that would have reified and kind of reified into a new identity, that they can't take hold in the same way in the moment. So by it's that very capacity of feeling more, being in more intimate, that actually creates more disidentification. And I wonder what you think about that, and what your biases or your view of the where we're developing to. You talked about the deeper aspects of ourselves earlier.
Well, so much. It's interesting to me. This has happened again and again. Is that you're really on the same similar track as how I see it? So there is this kind of congruity between what you just said and what how I hold it, which I'll share with you. That, and I completely agree with you about the, that it's a lot easier to be quote unquote enlightened meditating in a cave than in an intimate relationship with a significant other. We probably, most of us, have experienced that. So yeah, of course, if you're alone and meditating, you can tap into a certain kind of flow, but it's not juicy. It's not the same juiciness as the word you use, and I use that word too myself. So it has more to do then with living your life fully on this planet, but not taking all of the drama that we create on this planet as seriously as we once did. Now, of course, there's some drama that people, when people are actually getting hurt or injured or, all kinds of things that the difficult things that happen on this planet. I'm not saying not to take those things seriously, but I'm talking about on an emotional level, on a personal level, not to get involved in so much drama, not to be so thin-skinned about things, because it's not about us anyway. It's not per so much of what we have always taken to be personal really isn't personal. But we don't know that, and just knowing it in our head is not enough. So it's that embodied peace. When you know it in your bones and in your cells, it does lead to just what you described. There's a fluidity that happens. And you, I when I talk about, again, we're kind of getting into kind of some more advanced levels here, but when I talk about identifications, now that's a word that's used in spiritual work too, but I talk about identifications are held in the body as in the form of tension and collapse, which I touched on earlier. So that as, and that means a frozen, fixed, and stuck quality. And what we do experience is as these old identifications dissolve, there is a fluidity that happens in the body. There is a sense of flow that we experience that was not available. And that flow is connected to joy and aliveness and play and creativity, and has nothing to do with not being productive, because productivity can be hugely joyful when it's coming from a real and embodied place. So all of those things are possible, but either from a overdetermined or survival style place, or from the real place in us as human beings, where our juice is and where our life is.
Maybe this comes to as well, like there's aliveness has an intelligence to it, I mean, it's in a way, it's I'm maybe you have a lot to say on this, but I'm just thinking out loud. But aliveness is something we all n it's so palpable to us, it's like if someone asks you are you alive or not, you say I'm alive. And yet it's kind of a mystery at the same time, it's and I'm feeling there's a sense of intelligence perhaps in inside that aliveness, like life can move more fluidly, and it seems like we need more of that in the world right now. And it maybe connects me just to one quick comment I'll make, which is, I used to feel my spiritual practice was about kind of identifying into a kind of, spacious awareness. And it's not that I've gone away from that. But it was like there was a kind of slight dissociated feeling from that, maybe. Whereas now I'm much more interested in a kind of like the intimacy and fluid flow of experience. And relationality itself, Dan Siegel and many others I've heard talk about how like the relationship between things is maybe even more primary than the things that kind of arise themselves. So I know we're getting into like I'm taking us into the weeds a bit, but I don't know if there was a question in there, but
Well, maybe, I mean, just the R in NARM stands for relational. That's how significant I see this piece. Relationship to self, relationship to other people, relationship to the world, relationship to the universe or something bigger than ourselves. So for me, relationality is a key factor too. And you're right. I didn't invent this word. I don't remember. I don't know who did it, but there's this thin spiritual bypass that sometimes people will do. So they can get to maybe some very real expanded, seemingly expanded states or really expanded spiritual states, but by bypassing their human experience. And so for me, it's really more about not bypassing the human experience, living life with all of its juice and all of its challenges, and staying and finding increasing connection to self, others, and the universe in that process. And so to go back to the process of disidentification, which is again a word that I borrowed from spiritual work, is that I often get the question, well, if we continue to disidentify, well, then who are we when we're disidentified? Now, sometimes I'll play the, I never pretend to be anybody's guru, but sometimes I'll play the guru role and say, oh, that's a very good question, you know, or something like that. But one of the, what I do find, you know, in two major traditions, like in, you know, the more devotional the traditions, it's the heart, you know, Sufism, esoteric Christianity, and so on. In other traditions, it's more mental, like Buddhism, you know, where you're focusing on emptiness more and others focusing on fullness. For me, they're two sides of the same coin. And so it leads to a flow, aliveness, connection, heartfulness, increasing emptiness because we're not taking ourselves so seriously. All of these bound up energetic, you know, all these identifications that are bound up energy basically are softening and releasing. And again, to quote the famous Hungarian psychologist whose name is Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, some of your, it isn't spelled like that because there's all kinds of L's in there that apparently are not pronounced in Hungarian. But he was an expert in flow, and that flow experience is available to all of us. And it comes, in my experience, with deep connection, deep heartfulness, emptiness, a combination of all of those because they're not exclusive one to the other.
And I imagine love too. Love.
Sorry. Oh, love. Well, when we're in our hearts, you know, when we're connected to our hearts, that love is one of the capacities of the heart. And it's interesting, we keep going to the kind of some of the deeper levels of Dharma, because in Dharma I talk about the, you know, for many of us, it's just focusing on capacities, developing more capacity for, you know, emotional capacity, not just physical capacities, although those are an important expression too. But I also do make it explicit in Dharma about states of being. And so that when we're truly in our heart, various aspects of beingness actually do arise. So the capacity for love is an important one. Compassion is another one. Courage, though it comes from the French word, from heart. All of these are heart qualities that we have more access to the more we are able to really access our heart. And just to share a little story with you, I didn't know this when I first started teaching this, but in one of my trainings, I think it was in Germany at one point, I was talking about, you know, exploring the obstacles in the way, and somebody brought me a quote. It turns out it was a quote from Rumi. And I had not seen it before, but I've used it since, which is something I'll misquote it to some degree, so bear with me. But it was like, don't go looking for love. Look for the internal obstacles that you've developed against love. And that's very, they show that to me because it's consistent with my work, with the NARM work of, you know, that love is what's left when there are the obstacles that were once there to love, usually through hurt and various kinds of things that we disconnected from the deeper part of our nature, which is loving.
I'm so pleased you bring this in because I think this is missing from a lot of, I mean, I can't speak too much for therapeutic models, but I think it's probably missing from a bunch of them. And in coaching too, these qualities of heartfulness, or I might call them qualities of presence that arise when one, you know, is able to integrate or, you know, disidentify from parts. The model I've used, which I've from one of my mentors, is, you know, you can disidentify from parts and bring love to those parts. And which often opens up more flow of experience and can drop us into an experience of wholeness, of presence, where, you know, qualities like love and compassion and strength can arise, from which within which then we can act skillfully. But they're not strategic. You know, it's not the kind of faux confidence or the faux love that can exist prior to that. It's a spontaneous kind of expressed. Yeah.
Well, we're on the same page there. I resonate with just about everything you said. So I agree with all that.
Lawrence, feels like we're moving to a close. But I wonder if there's anything you want to share with people, anything we haven't mentioned that actually you think is really important to bring into the conversation.
Oh, that's a good and challenging question to kind of and maybe I'll just go back to that very first thing that I said is the spontaneous movement in all of us is to the heart, is towards connection, is towards love. And we've all learned various ways to disconnect from that because we were hurt as children. And we were looking at the world through a child's eyes. And for many people, we developed a worldview by the time we're 6 years old, which is a common understanding in psychology. But the deep implications of that is that we continue to view the world through that distorted lens. Because, of course, the child takes everything personally. There is no other way for a child. But as adults, we can experience it differently, not just as a mental construct, not just as a, rationalization, but as a real and in-depth and embodied understanding. And so if I were to sum up our whole conversation, I just like to remind people of that. And as you said earlier, we don't have to will ourselves to get to that place. As a matter of fact, trying to will ourselves to get to that place, those places get in our way. But when we pay attention and we do the emotional and other kinds of work that are part of, that process, that's where it all leads.
That's a beautiful ending and an invitation for us. Lawrence, I just want to thank you I just really enjoyed myself, and I
Me
just want
too.
to kind of really express my gratitude for the depth of exploration and expertise and wisdom you bring that's led to the creation of this work. So,
Well,
yeah.
thanks so much. It's really been a pleasure being here with you too. And Ralph thought that there would be a nice synergy between us, and that's what I've experienced in our conversation today.
Yeah, great. We'll link when it comes out, if you want. We'll link to that coach offering
Okay.
and on the notes page. And is there, can we find out more about your work? Do you want to name any resources or your website?
Yeah, of course. You can Google NARM, and there's a NARM Training Institute, which is both US based and but also touches international through virtual, through our virtual programs. And then I've also got trainings all over, just about in every country in Eastern and Western Europe these days. That's through my personal website, drlawrenceheller.com. I think that's the right name. But it's just Google me, Lawrence with a U. And you can find all of the international and particularly Eastern and Western European trainings that we offer.
Thanks, Lawrence. Yeah, I highly encourage people listening to check that out.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. And just a reminder about our upcoming live training, The Art of Developmental Coaching. This program shows you how to hear what's underneath your client's words so you can get to the heart of their challenges. And what's amazing is when you do that, you can actually get access to the source code of change itself. So while you're helping them solve the issue at hand, you're also guiding them into their next evolution. It's a beautiful thing to witness. So just go to coachesrising.com/developmental coaching to book your spot. Early bird enrollment is open until the 3rd of October.